We get a second aspect. So there's this rise in the idea of the artist and culture as important factors in the economy, the innovation economy. We've also got this rise of the idea of the entrepreneur. Now, people talk about entrepreneurialism as if it's an obvious thing. Again, it's very highly constructed and very historically specific. In the 1950s and 60s, entrepreneurs were quite marginal figures. They were seen as people in the lower bits of the economy. I think, you know, maybe in China they would be the street traders. You know, the entrepreneurs are people who sell things on the streets, you know, cigarettes or, you know, buns, you know, the street traders. The real economic force was in the big industries, the big forest industries, and they were run by technicians, scientists, management, you know, people involved in management. And it's what people call the organisation men, the Fordist organisation men. They dominated in the 1950s and 60s. But as in the 1970s, we ran into some sort of crisis, economic crisis. These big industries were seen as a problem. And many people on the, and this is the origin of neoliberalism, but we won't talk about that today. Many people went back to an old economist, Schumpeter, an Austrian economist, who'd been writing in the 1940s, really. And he talked about how capitalism, it did have crises, and he was very much against the Soviet Union, writing against social democracy. And he was saying, yes, capitalism does have crises, but it doesn't mean revolution, it doesn't mean collapse. It actually means it can reinvent itself. Capitalism reinvents itself. And it reinvents itself by what he called creative destruction. And it destroys, when it comes into crisis, it destroys the existing arrangements, and new kinds of markets, new kinds of production come through. In many ways, it's sort of a Marx turned against himself in some ways. So creative destruction is about breaking the rules, breaking routines, going outside what everybody else does. These are what the entrepreneurs do. For Schumpeter, it's the entrepreneurs who develop these new markets, develop the new products. And they're, at first, they're marginal. They're on the edges because everybody's doing it in this way. But entrepreneurs worked around the system, pushed at its boundaries, explored new territories, confronted stale, old ways of doing things. So in the 1970s, the entrepreneur, instead of being some small street traders just after a bit of money, now entrepreneurs become the visionaries and the risk takers. The entrepreneur becomes the rebel. And in the 1960s and 70s, the rebel was a positive figure. You know, the rebel was, you know, the great rebellion of, this was a good thing. And of course, it's very much linked, the creative entrepreneur becomes very much linked to the operation of artists, especially avant-garde artists. You think about Andrew's lectures last week about the avant-garde, breaking the rules, smashing the existing art world. You know, creative destruction is what modern art does. A famous Australian critic wrote a book called The Shock of the New. This is what modernism was, the shock of the new. We would, by showing you some, you know, the new, we would shock you into change. So it's a artists have a different approach to knowledge. They look at things in a different way. They articulate, they express experience in different ways. They challenge the way we think about the world. And of course, remember last week we talked about the artistic critique of capitalism, that art should change life. And it gave it, as we saw, it gave it a very revolutionary role. It was very much about, art was often revolutionary. But in this, in the 1980s, maybe these two were put together, because we've got Schumpeter's creative destruction, we've got modern art's creative destruction, and we've got this idea that maybe entrepreneurs and artists are not too different after all. It used to be that people making money were the bourgeois, people making art with the Bohemians, the cultural people. Now these two come together. And entrepreneurs and artists are rebels. They break the rules. They're the productive rebels who glimpse the outline of the future. And it's a major, I think it's a major cultural shift and very important to understand. But the third element, is the actual rise of the cultural economy. Because although the entrepreneur and the role of creativity and innovation are absolutely important, we also get the rise of the cultural economy itself. In the 90s, huge markets in commercial cultural commodities, CDs, film, books, television, that's important. But also, there's an increased symbolic or cultural content in other goods and services. So we get the rise of design, we get the rise of cultural tourism. Cultural tourism in Europe is the biggest industry in Europe. We've got the idea of experience goods, where when we buy a fridge now, we don't just buy it because it keeps our Coca-Cola cold. We buy it because it looks great. Or we buy a kitchen now not because we cook. In fact, we never cook. We just bring something in and put it in the microwave. But we like the image of the kitchen. You know, it's like, you know, we begin to buy things because of how they appeal to our aesthetic sense. So the cultural economy is both the rise of cultural commodities in one sense, but also the spreading of aesthetics throughout the rest of the economy. And it's, I found this in Taiwan, it's what somebody in the 80s called the aestheticization of everyday life. Horrible word, but it means that maybe our everyday life is becoming more about aesthetics. We buy things because of what they look like, but also we construct our identity not based on old communal sense of who we are, where we were born, our class, our occupation, but of how we consume. And in the West, this was called a lifestyle, which is a new word, or was a new word. We construct our identity and our lifestyle through consumption. So the cultural economy becomes very important in this way. But the cultural economy is something else, isn't it? Cultural economy is also about a new kind of post-Fordist industry. I said before how the cultural industries were very difficult industries. They were strange, irrational industries. And that in the 1990s, they had become cutting edge. Well, they became cutting edge because they suddenly became post-Fordist industries. They were about niche products. They were about just-in-time production. They were about flexible specialization. All these words are economist words for this new kind of post-Fordist economy. We've got a consumption-led economy of niche, but also of difference. Remember, Adorno was saying everybody's going to have the same thing produced in big culture factories. Now, everybody can have their own thing. They can choose whatever they want. What we produce now is not the same, but what we produce is difference. We're the difference industry. And this is because we've got, you know, it's a consumer economy, it's got feedback loops, etc. And creative industries, more than any other industry, specialize in these skills. They specialize in these skills of appealing to difficult markets, niche markets, fast-moving markets. They specialize in customer feedback. That's what they've always done. You know, they've always done that. But now, these become absolutely essential skills for the rest of the economy. So creative industries become almost like, you know, in there, they've got more of those skills than any other part of the economy, and we should learn from them, you know. So creative industry skills are at a premium, and they go from a backwards to the cutting edge of the new economy. And so, just coming back, creativity emerges as a universal good. Cultural and symbolic dimension is now a major source of value across the economy. The skills of those within the creative industry are at a premium. They're very, very valuable. Well, these are now, everybody likes pop culture. Everybody likes commercial culture. So we've got this idea that this opposition has gone. Culture and economy are coming together to begin a new, more productive, more creative age. And if you read works such as John Hartley's book, this is, it's almost like wide-eyed. Finally, the elitist art has gone. Finally, art and industry are coming together. Or if you read John Hawking's book, The Creative Economy, finally, it's all going to be great. Well, I don't think so. And I'm just going to go through some questions, problems here, and some of them I've mentioned altogether. First of all, the simple question that everybody asks is, well, okay, what's not creative? If you're going to say this industry is about creativity, you know, whether it's creativity as an input or creativity as an output, but what's not creative? Because is science not creative? Is business not creative? Is everyday life not creative? You know, trying to get to work on time, finding the best way to go on the metro system, but that's creative. What's not creative? John Hawkins, his book, The Creative Economy, he says it's about patents, trademarks, designs, and copyright. All these different forms of intellectual property. Well, you know, if you read Bloomberg, if you look on Bloomberg, you know, the business channel, or you read, there's business information. There are patents around science about, intellectual property does not apply simply to creative industries. In fact, creative industry is a small sector of that. And of course, we get Richard Florida, famous international guru, who talks about the creative class. Everybody's going to get the creative class. And you look at his statistics, and who's the creative class? Lawyers, scientists, accountants, doctors. It's basically the professional class. Anybody who is not working class is a creative class. So it's everybody, or huge lumps of people. And so all this idea of creativity, it's clear, it's not very precise. We can't say these industries are creative, these industries deal in intellectual property, these industries are part of the creative class, and these are not. It's actually impossible to do on that. And I think there's been some real problems with this idea of this definition of creative industries. But what about creativity in this sector? Because, in fact, when you look at creative industries, in fact, as I showed in that list before, most governments that say let's promote the creative industries more or less stick to the cultural industries. Maybe they add a few things on. I know in Korea they add nanotechnology on, but most of them stick to creative industries. But these are some other words to describe the value of this sector. Maybe they add aesthetic value, or is it cultural value, or symbolic value, or expressive value? Do they deal in texts and meaning? Are they identity goods? Are they experience economies? These are all different ways of describing this sector in some way. And I think creativity is really just a word. And as you really begin to look closely at it, its meaning begins to disappear. However, I think what is clear is that however people describe creativity, what they're really talking about is artistic or cultural creativity. That I know they all say everybody's creative, business, but in fact, what they're really talking about is this artistic or cultural creativity, as I tried to explain. That somehow they're using the idea of this intuitive, sensory, non-rational or not quite rational way of knowledge. They're using that idea of creativity and the culture that it produces. That's what's at the heart of this notion. But at the same time, they deny it's anything to do with these artistic and cultural histories of creativity. That's just old. That debate, all those debates we saw last week, that's the past. Now creativity is part of the economy. Creativity is no problem, you know. So it's an argument. It really is an argument about the changing relationship between culture and economy, economics, that I think is it's a very complex argument. And this is why I would say that the creative industries as an idea is very ideological. Not because there are no creative industries, or not because, simply because it refuses to engage with these questions of culture that have been very important to us. It refuses to acknowledge that they exist, and that's my definition of ideology. So I think that what the cultural industries, and later the creative industries, came out of is not some sort of growth of the economic, of the information economy, or the growth of the knowledge economy. It comes out of cultural change. It comes out of us, the way we've changed our values, the way we change our lives. It certainly in the West, and it's happening in its own way in China, the rise of the cultural economy, if you like, expresses the transformation of our own lives since the 1960s. And we are in a period of crisis. We're in a period of rapid change, rapid cultural change, and I think we need to be aware of these cultural questions and not just say, oh, it's just aesthetic consumption, it's just identity consumption. We need to keep hold of the cultural questions hidden by the creative economies. So I would say, and I'll go quickly through this, I would say we've had a transformation of the life world, a transformation of what our culture is. I can't go into too much detail about it now, but I think since the 1960s, since 1968, we have had a challenge to traditional social values, to traditional culture, and to traditional notions of economics. And it goes back to the artistic critique of capitalism that I talked about before. Change life. We don't just want more money, we want to change life. And again, the idea of the bohemian, the artist, the marginal person, you know, defeats the organisation. Suddenly, in this idea, we don't just want a job for life. This is the 1960s, maybe now we want one. But then, we don't want a job for life. We don't want to start at the age of 18, you know, leave university, start our job, go to the next bit, oh, got married, go next bit, oh, we've got a house, next bit, then we die, you know. Do we want this? No, we want meaningful world, meaningful life, meaningful work, sorry. So, you know, big critiques of this, and I think the cultural changes come out of this. So we're not just dealing with somehow industry going from Europe to China, but we're dealing with new aspirations, new kinds of identities, new kinds of communities, new kinds of art and culture. And this cultural revolution, if I can use the term, this cultural revolution came from the grassroots, came from the bottom up. And I think this is really important to remember. Because I think the creative industries have stolen this idea and turned it to a pure economic thing. We've, you know, the problems of post-industrial modernity, maybe they're just beginning in China, but the problems of these big industrial cities that no longer have industry, the problems of a new kind of modernity, you know, we found them on that they were played out on the urban stage. It was played out in everybody, people's the culture of cities. And it's very much part of popular culture. And one of the things that the 1960s saw was that cultural production, the right to produce culture, the right to use a camera, or to make music, or to write books, or to produce films, whatever, this should be open to everybody. Everybody could be a cultural production. So, you know, the strong senses of that. And popular culture was also about a renegotiation of national and local identities. You know, my country, England, the UK, was an imperialist country, centre of the financial and industrial world. And then it lost an empire, it declined, economic decline, industrial decline. America was suddenly the big boss of the world after England used to be the big boss of the world. The cities of England began to get poorer and poorer. How do we deal with that? As a question of identity, how do you deal with that? How do you turn yourself from an imperial, military, hierarchical country into something else? And I think popular music was about that, or partly about that. So what I'm talking about is a huge wave of democratic culture that's coming about. And it came out as a critique of cultural policy. In the 1970s, people began to criticise the way in which art and culture were funded. So maybe last week we talked about Pierre Bourdieu, the idea that art is just a culture of the middle class. Or other people said, art's just stuck in museums and gallery. We need to get it out and connect with everyday life. We get the rise of community arts movement, that art's not just about, you know, some small groups of people, but let's have arts in the community, in community centres. So generally we've got this idea of a more active participation in cultural production, a really strong challenge. And it was part of this idea that, of this artistic critique of capitalism, a meaningful life. While the Schumpeteer and entrepreneurs were out there saying, we're going to transform capitalism, actually many of the culture producers were working in the big cities of North America, of Europe, where they began to say, let's change life in cities. They didn't want to work in 9-to-5 jobs. They didn't want to go to boring old jobs. And they began to try and make a living through culture. And they weren't getting money from the state. They somehow had to make money themselves. So it was commercial culture, because otherwise they die. They had to make money. But it wasn't a culture industry. These were small-scale culture producers. And this was part of a radical democratic political agenda. Culture should be for everybody. Cities should be about active culture. And these are the new popular cultures. You see it in punk. Anybody knows punk? I know now it's just people with silly hair, but it was a much more radical movement. Or a bit later, that what we call the hot summers in Italy and France and Germany, where young people went on the streets of the city and said, this is boring. We've got a right to transform our cities into cities that we like and we feel part of. So popular culture was actually alternative culture. So we get new urban spaces, new technologies, new cultural spaces. What we've seen with the internet, people say, everybody on the internet, everybody can write a blog, everybody can do a little digital thing and put it on YouTube or whatever. But that goes back a long time. It goes back to the 1960s when technologies get cheaper. So I always like to show this one. This is the first issue of a very famous magazine published in 1976. And, it's embarrassing now. Anybody with a computer can do a much better job than that. But they were doing it. They were cutting out from newspapers and, sticking them on paper and then going to a new machine called a photocopier. Wow. And put it on the photo. And this was made, you can see at the top there, there's a staple, they just put it by hand, But this was a new kind of culture. We can do this. We can make these things. And the band there, of course, punk rock, was about doing it yourself. And there's a very famous... This was the first page of one of them. I don't know if you can understand it, but he says, do it yourself. And it says, here's one chord. Here's another chord. This is a third chord. Now go out and make a band. And this was amazing. This was like, anybody can do it. That's it. Three chords. Go on. You can be in a band. So it was a real sense of democratic culture. And, I've used this Samizdat, the use of photocopiers, very cheap printing machines. This is Russian. This is the name for underground literature, made typewriters and photocopiers. But also in the UK, When I was a student, we used tapes. You know, we didn't download from the internet, because there wasn't internet, but we copied tapes, you know. And these are from Manchester. These are the sort of, I think, amazing bands that came out. This is a very, very, maybe I'll talk about this tomorrow, show you some DVD. This is a band by New Order, called New Joy Division, sorry. And this was an 18-year-old design student, came out of my university, Manchester University. He designed this. He's now a multi-millionaire, very, very famous designer called Peter Saville. But, you know, this was all happening in little rooms in the city, little rooms in the back street. Another band, again, you might not know these people, but the Smith, very, very famous band, just came out of Manchester, you know, in the 70s. This is Factory Records. This is probably about 1980, Factory Records. This is Russian constructivism, but it's also factories, Andy Warhol's art collective in New York. So we've got New York in the 1970s, The Factory, it was called, Andy Warhol. You've got Russian avant-garde, and you've got Manchester come together, produce a new record label. And they say, we're not going to go through the big record labels, we're going to do it ourselves. Again, now, you can do it on the internet straight away, but this was brand new. The idea that you could make your own records, yeah, you just get some plastic and a machine and go like that. It was like a revelation. These are more designed. So, in the 1970s, many cultural theorists and politicians began to say, right, okay, listen, we need a new cultural policy. Because the vast majority of cultural consumption is coming out of the market, not out of subsidized art. So, what's a democratic cultural policy? I mean, this is a very serious question. I think it's a question we should continue to ask today. What is a democratic cultural policy? What's the role of the market, commercial culture within that? And in the 1980s, many cities, especially London, but quite a number of cities in the UK, began to promote the cultural industries. They were no longer negative things, as with Adorno, the culture industry, bad things. Actually, they became positive, as I've tried to say. They became a new kind of democratic culture. So to promote the cultural industries was both to promote democratic culture and some kind of local economic development, because all these people were local. They weren't national, international companies, or local. So it was using the market mechanism to local advantage. So cities and locality became a site for new kinds of economic and cultural strategies, new kinds of urban policies. And I think this is a crucial thing to hold together, because they came up with new kinds of policy tools. Because before then, how do you have an arts policy? You give money to big institutions, or maybe you have programs to give money to small artists. But now we've got a different approach, because we can't give money to everybody. Who would give money to every rock and roll band that appeared? It's stupid. You fund infrastructure. You give money to things like galleries, but also cinemas, but maybe recording studios. We don't need them now, maybe. But we begin to fund cultural infrastructure. This afternoon, we will argue that the creative clusters in Shanghai should be seen as cultural infrastructure, not just as real estate things. Maybe we should fund business support and skills. Because if these people are doing business, how do they know how to do it? Can we develop new kinds of skills for them? Can we look at new kinds of economic development tools, you know, look using the value chain or maybe the value ecosystem? Can we analyse culture using economic models to give us an idea of how best we can help? What's the mix of creative and non-creative? You know, using a camera is creative. Doing the budget or managing or even cleaning up is a non-creative skill. But they're both essential. How do we mix the two together? And of course, we began to think early on of reprogramming old industrial buildings. We'll talk about that this afternoon. Can we use old industrial buildings to produce culture? And a whole series of audits and surveys and mapping, you know, statistic analysis of the sector. So an emergency, if this is a new cultural policy, a democratic cultural policy, but it does use economic and other kinds of tools. And we've also got a new dialogue. Policy makers began to talk to creative industries, try to understand their language, try to understand their need. And this was a big shift, because previously, you know, the arts ministries or the arts committees, you know, we know what arts are, we know what people need, and we give the money out. But now they began to talk to them more and began to say, well, can we work in collaboration? Can we learn from you? So the cultural industries were about the local initially. The whole agenda was driven by cities often. It was about local level, it was about independence, it was about people often not for profit. They made a living. We call them not for profit. They make a living, but they're not going to make lots of profits. Small businesses. And these small producers have very strong links to locality. They're part of its identity. And they feed back into its cultural infrastructure. So to support local culture production is, so the theory goes, to support employment and local economic development. You know, the two do go together, or could go together. One of my problems with the creative industries is that it just takes one dimension. It uses this argument about, you know, new democratic culture, but it says, right, it's an economic engine, and that's all it is concerned about. And my interest in the cultural and creative industries is how we can put these back together, how we can keep the cultural and the economic together. Because I think part of the question is about economics. I mean, you know, we live in a real world. This is an economic sector. It is an economic sector. They make money, sometimes a lot of money, but not all of it. But it's also about democratic culture production. It is about everybody's right to enjoy culture, to produce culture if they want to. And it's also about the right to the city. You know, it's about using the city, enjoying the city, the cultural life of the city. And my final line is that the creative industries agenda, as I've tried to show, takes one little bit of this and makes it a strong economic argument, and it ignores these other cultural dimensions. And I think that's wrong in a cultural sense, in a political sense, but it also is wrong in an economic sense. Because if you remember right at the beginning, I said these are industries whose economic value is part of their, comes from their cultural value. So if you focus heavily on economics, on promoting the economic dimension, you will end up with no creative industries at all, or cultural industries. And I think, as we'll see this afternoon, that's some of the problems with creative clusters in Shanghai. So that's the end.